Hey everybody, welcome to Real Life Sci-Fi with Wade and Willie. I'm Wade.
I'm Willie.
This is a podcast about the paranormal and contemporary mythology. Join us on patreon.com/reallifesci-fi for access to two bonus episodes a week, video feeds, and more. Visit reallifesci-fi.show for all of our links. Oh, we're getting the Twitch thing back, maybe. Willie finally approved the art for our paranormal Indian weird narrative our Indian podcast.
Audio podcast. Yeah.
If you've been listening to the show, you know what we're talking about. We kind of let it go, but maybe it'll come back. Let's welcome aboard the SSRLSF. The book is called Who They Are and What They're Up To. It's Leslie and Stephen Shaw.
Yay.
Hi, you two. How you doing?
Howdy. What's up? How are you guys?
We're great out here in Southern California. Nice.
Enjoying the desert.
Yep, sunny weather.
Now, great. I know nothing about you. Willie, don't be insulted. I don't know anything. You guys are a married couple. And what I'm gleaming so far from our conversation off mic is you've seen UFOs or what's the deal?
Yes, we're both UFO witnesses.
Yes.
And Stephen and his family, we believe, we're victims of the abduction phenomenon.
For multiple generations, at least three that I've been able to track so far.
Yeah, we believe it went back multiple generations in his family.
Is the book about that?
Not so much. We refer to our experiences at the beginning of the book just to give people some reference for where we're coming from and who we are.
And a lot of also our motivation for writing the book in the first place.
Right.
It's great that you are also both what I would deem credible witnesses, a journalist and, you know, you've had some military experience and correct. It's just like things that make you worth listening to. So that's great to me, you know, because anybody can witness stuff and a lot of people do. I've seen hundreds of UFOs.
Okay. But you got, okay. Can we,
of course, the voice of reason.
He will see a light going across the sky at night, and he says that's a UFO. We got a real high powered lens on a camera, and so that we could zoom into these things, and they're hard to catch because with the zoom it's hard to follow them. We caught a couple of Mylar balloons. Is he seeing UFOs? In your opinion, these just lights in the night sky?
Actually, I know what you mean. A light up in the sky can be many different things. And one of the ways you can tell if you're looking at a UFO is if it suddenly behaves in such a way that only UFOs can behave. For instance, my first UFO, it was a white light in the sky. And that could have been, I don't know, a Chinese lantern, a helicopter not running its running lights.
An airplane coming.
Yeah, any number of things. Yeah. But then it took
satellite.
Off.
Right. Yeah, of course.
It was too bright for that. But then it took off at
a real bright satellite.
20,000 miles an hour, just from a dead stop at speed, gone over the northern horizon in less than a quarter of a second. And we both saw it happen. And it's like it streaked out into a line. It moved so fast visually. And that line collapsed after it. But the whole thing in less than a quarter.
Yeah, we're driving from east to west on the Highway 62 from Joshua Tree
to Yucca Valley.
This is nighttime in the 2005.
Right. Another time, Stephen saw a UFO that came up out of the ocean. That's another way of determining whether you're seeing a real UFO. Is it transmedium? Can it go in and out of the ocean at will and then up into space?
I saw that. You know, saw that one with a witness. This was in October of 2004. The Yankees and the Boston Red Sox were in the playoffs, and I was at the Chart House, which is right on the coast off of Malibu. And I went out to get my car. I asked the valet to get my car, and he got my car for me. And we just happened to look out to the ocean because we're right on the beach. And this UFO came up out of the water and out of the ocean and just kind of hovered there, maybe, I don't know, maybe 100 feet above the surface. And then did a couple of weird moves and then shot off over going up north, up the north of the coast. And we both,
again, towards the north. Yeah.
We both looked at each other and he said, did you see that? I said, oh yeah, I saw that.
And when he says this did some strange moves, more like it does, these things move in ways that our planes cannot move.
Yeah, it wasn't
like in V turns, you know, like a V instead of a U-turn. And at speed, too, they don't slow down to make these V turns. When you're seeing something like that, you know you're seeing a real UFO.
This
and not
defies
a Chinese lantern,
the
you know?
extent of our technological advances. You know,
this is 04, by the way, when I saw this too. And
the pilots who describe it at the hearing last summer in the Congress, they said this
did
is
guys
an
get
order
arrested?
Of magnitude well
oh,
above
oh,
our
oh,
technology.
Oh, pardon? What was that? Did we get arrested?
Did you get arrested for seeing aliens? Well, you had to go speak at a. Are you talking about the UAP?
No, we're talking.
Oh no, no, this is the congressional hearings.
Congressional hearings.
The pilots that were at the congressional hearings last summer, UAP hearings in front of Congress, they testified to this technology being an order of magnitude much farther than ours. So it can't just be Russia developing something, you know, ahead of us.
I mean, fingers crossed, it's not right.
Right, not China.
Game over. Game over. If that's the case.
Yeah, if we're Kim Jong Un, we'd be gone by now. You know, so.
I mean, we know it's not the Russians because Ukraine's hanging in there. Yeah,
right.
And the Tic Tac incident, for instance, it was a carrier group. The Nimitz is the carrier.
Oh, we've talked a lot about the Nimitz.
Yeah, but they already
know about that.
But the Princeton,
we know about it. Skip it. Just skip it. I'm joking. Wait, but I feel like we've buried the lead here because you said you used really sort of like towing the line language, but you mentioned abduction.
Yes.
So what's the story? Three generations.
My story starts when I was 3 years old. I grew up in Southern California in a suburb of.
Wait, hang on. I'm sorry. Let me stop you. I'm sorry. I prompted you. Uh-huh. Willie, should we wait? Should we do the wow scale and then get into this stuff? This feels like.
Yeah.
For now, let's do the wow scale real quick.
Wow scale.
Are you a Wed or are you a Willie?
Wow Scale stands for Waiter Willie. It's a 5-question quiz. At the end of the quiz, I will give you a score anywhere between 0 and 5. If you're more of a 5, you're more of a Willie. If you're more of a 0, you're more of a Wade, meaning a skeptic or a believer, right?
Okay.
Because there's two of you, let's just do yes, no answers. Okay.
Okay.
Are you ready to be weighed on the Wow Scale?
Okay.
Yes.
First question, 3-parter. Do you believe in aliens? If so, have they visited Earth? If so, have they visited Earth in the last 300 years?
Yes.
You're going to say, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, okay. All right. Ghosts.
Yes.
Yes, and actually my sister and her husband in Northern England are ghost hunters right now.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Did they get any?
Yes, they've actually caught a lot of interesting stuff.
Yeah.
They even got their website.
The
exactly.
For it and...
They have the equipment.
What's the website?
They're on Instagram and Facebook. They're ghostly locations.
Ghostly locations. All right. Are they British? Yeah. Why are they in England?
My sister wanted to marry a British man, so she married a British man and she moved to England.
His parents were English. they were living in England, and they immigrated here to California, where Stephen and the whole family were born.
Yes, and yeah, all the kids were born here. Yes.
But Karen, went back to the old country.
Yes,
oh, your parents are British?
Yes.
Both Northern England. They went through World War II. Let me sweep you back to
your childhood real quick.
Right.
Stephen, it's time for bed.
You want some tea and crumpets?
In it. Third question. Bigfoot.
Yes.
Yes.
There's evidence to all show right, that Bigfoot right. is real.
Yes.
A lot of evidence, actually. DNA evidence.
DNA evidence now.
Now we're getting to, wait, okay, hang on. What is the DNA evidence?
There's an unknown primate in
Northern California.
They've
been doing a DNA stuff where they collect water from rivers, and they, you know, we've we've gotten to the point now where we can analyze what type of animal is peeing in the water. You know? And there is an unknown primate that is I'm not shutting up. It's true. You can talk to Sam Kitchen about that and other people are doing it. Actually, there's the DNA does not lie. People do. DNA does not. So
great. That's right.
Yeah, we heard about it when we went to Contact in the Desert. We went to a Bigfoot lecture there. They talked about this woman, scientist who has isolated the Bigfoot genome. And then they were talking about how they did it, which was the it's called environmental archaeology, where they take, like I said, creek water and analyze anything that's living around it. You know what I mean?
You know, get population densities. It was first designed for that population. There's like enough predators in an area, whether it's predator deficient or something like that. So
right, and then another,
and they would know if it's just a chimpanzee hanging out.
Oh yeah, so. Yes, because they already have that in the genome base.
We know that one, yeah.
So it doesn't match anything.
Oh, so it's like they have no idea what it is.
It's something that is primate. Cool. Yeah, unknown. It's an unknown in the primate. And genome family.
They also got a lot of it from this hair sampling. What happened was a man surprised a Bigfoot, or a Bigfoot surprised a man, and the Bigfoot ran away around this cabin and bumped hard into the wall of the cabin. And the man saw that, and there was the hair stuck into the wall of the cabin. So he had that tested and also came back as an unknown primate.
He's a regular Harry in the Henderson. He's a big Bigfoot klutz running into walls. That's hilarious.
He was scared, you know.
No, he's a klutz. You know? He's a klutz. It's funnier if he's a klutz.
Yeah, not everybody has got Simone Biles reflex.
Yeah, really.
The Gomer Pyle of Bigfoots.
What do you say there now? All right. Here's where we're going to get interesting, though, on the WoW scale. Fourth question, psychics. You guys buy into that stuff?
Yes.
We have, I believe, just to make, yes. Okay, make it easy. Yes.
Make it easy, yes. Stephen's family is a very psychic bunch, in fact.
Okay. This is the last question, and this one gets a little abstract. Do you believe that we are living in a simulation, or do you believe in simulation theory kind of like as a blanket?
No.
We're going to know for Steven.
Big no
both of
one,
you?
Yeah. No.
No, I think that's really, that's going down rabbit hole-y type stuff.
So. Yeah, we try not to go far down the rabbit hole.
But aliens and Bigfoot.
Aliens and Bigfoot, we're there.
Well,
those aren't rabbit holes.
Come on. No, that's, you got to really clarify what an alien is. And, you know, we, in our book, we talk about our theories about what's really going on. So, yeah.
Right.
Yeah. But as far as like, you know, traveling through wormholes and coming from Alpha Centauri, we don't believe in that.
Or interdimensional travel. No.
You don't believe in that?
No.
We don't believe in
that. Did you guys say hello to Stage Squatch, by the way? You can see him over Willie's left shoulder.
Oh, hey, Squatchy.
Oh, look at him.
Hey, it's Marv. Oh, hey, Marv, I haven't seen you for a while. You're looking a little bit stiff.
He hasn't been able to get out and, like, you know, run around. So you guys are straight up fives. You're both fives. Congratulations.
Woo!
I knew we were going to be. I just knew it.
All right, so without further ado, Willie, hit us with that topic.
Tonight on Real Life Sci-Fi, who they are and what they're up to. A book written by our guests, Leslie and Stephen Shaw, a history of UFO, UAP, and quote-unquote alien experiences. They have ideas of what these entities are and what they're doing here. So let's get into that tonight on Real Life Sci-Fi. And okay. I will say, first off, that it's been a while since I've read a book, and I just wanted to get through it, especially after listening to another show where the one of the hosts was like, I only got to so-and-so, and I was like, okay, finish the book.
How long is the book? How many pages? Like, I'm grading Willie here on his reading.
Is it 280? Oh, I'm sorry.
280 something.
280? Yeah. 286.
Okay.
And I will say, I definitely, if you're a listener of this show, you know that I fall in line with everything that we're going to talk about. And it, and like it was, you guys did a brilliant job of, first off, going through a history of recorded experiences, which, you know, that and there were a lot on there that, well, not a lot. There were a few on there that I hadn't heard of. I was like, oh, I got to check this out.
Researching it, I discovered some new ones too. So I thought, you know, even ufologists will find something new in those chapters.
And we left a few out too. Otherwise, it would have been too cumbersome too.
Yeah.
And then also, sequel, right? I said this earlier. Yes, it's great that a journalist, you've had military experience, and you've both witnessed stuff. And then Stephen having your experiences. This is what I always say. The whole point of having a conversation of what these things could be. And now that this information is being released officially,
more so
begs everyone to then go back and talk about all these other experiences that people have been having that have been just kind of erased from history because it's not a UAP. I feel like that's why they changed the name to UAP, to avoid all the UFO stuff that they now have to, they can deny. They can.
Yes, that helps. And also, it is a little bit more accurate, unidentified aerial phenomenon, because I guess sometimes they're not always flying, you know, and
it's just maybe, you know, again, it's just another way, like UFO, unidentified flying object. But it's, you know, that the UAP really came out after about like 2017, after Luis Elizondo and the
That also denies all this water, the transmedium stuff, you know. It's like,
right, does. That's what it does. It's basically, you know, waving the left hand while the right hand's doing some other stuff. It's just another way of confusing people.
Although, you know, for 80 years before that, they'd been just denying it was real at all. They would say, oh, it's swamp gas, or it's weather balloons or mass hysteria, anything except, you know, a real phenomenon. And we expected, after Luis Elizondo released his stuff to the New York Times, we expected the same response from them. And they surprised us all coming out saying, this is a real phenomenon. It's really happening. And then they said the lie after that, which is, we don't know what it is, but we know it's really happening. And of course, we know they know, because they have crashed ships. And the dead alien bodies, and maybe some live ones too.
Yeah, we call it the sandwich. Are you hiding a lie within two truths, or hiding a truth within two lies? It's the sandwich effect. It's just the way it works. You know,
are you guys encouraged by the release of this information, or do you feel like it's a smokescreen?
We are moderately encouraged from the standpoint that they're at least acknowledging that it's something that they don't understand.
We were grateful for that. And then now they're actually doing a lot more reports that are coming out about their study of UAPs and still finding them to be unknown or unexplainable. And we published our book in
October 31st of 2022.
And then right after that, January of 23, they issued a very detailed report about the study of 144 UAP incidents, most of which were military contacts. Yeah. And they basically came up with 143 of them were unexplainable still. Only one was finally explained as a collapsing weather balloon or something. And so a lot more stuff has been coming out. And then they held the hearings last summer where Grush himself, the whistleblower from the intelligence, he told the entire, I mean, this is not news to us that they have crashed ships and biologics, as he said, dead biologics of these creatures, because we knew that. But to hear it said on the House of Representatives floor of the House of Representatives was, and read into the congressional record, was really something.
And then Graves and Fravor, the pilots, you know, one from the West Coast, one from the East Coast. They're saying that that literally every time that they go out on maneuvers, whether it's either a nuclear submarine or an aircraft carrier armada or flotilla, it would be the same thing. They'd be dogged
by being followed.
So what they're saying is that they're still being discouraged strongly discouraged from even saying they're even seeing right. these things. So, and so really the 10,000, the 10,000 a year really probably is about 100,000 sightings. That also the Chinese and the Russians and the British are also
it's reporting happening to their military so as well.
It's not just us. It's worldwide.
And that was news to us. I mean, I knew they were dogging our military, but I didn't realize it was quite that well widespread. Both Fravor and Graves said it was happening every single time we went on maneuvers everywhere around the world. And they're monitoring our military everywhere we go, every time we go out.
And what do you think is the motive for that?
I think they're actually very concerned.
Yes,
I think they're very concerned that we are children, literally. We are actually children that are playing with toys that we really shouldn't be playing with.
We got some M80s, and we're going to blow our hands off.
Yes, like that type of thing. Yes, right. Exactly. I was told by my uncle when I was 8 years old, don't play around with an M80; you will blow your hand off. But
yeah,
we've been playing around with nukes now since 1945.
Let's just jump into it. I know that we're missing some stories that we want to talk about, but
sure.
One of the theories that you guys have in your book is that, and I love this because I always say aliens aren't driving here from other planets. So, right. And that's what people always say. What are they doing here? It takes so long to get here. I'm like, well, they don't need to drive here. And so one of your theories is that, yes, the whole alien thing is making us look up when we should be looking below. And so,
right.
You guys put forward the theory that, or your theory, which, you know, other people have too, but that they are a breakaway civilization that has developed their technology underground.
Yes, and they didn't lose their technology in the cataclysm that was. In our book, I wrote, at the time, the asteroid impact Hiawatha looked like the most promising candidate for the extinction event of 13,000 years ago. But since then, it's been refuted, which we must now refute that in our book. And it has been discovered that a comet hit, it's called the Younger Dryas comet, hit Lake Superior the correct number of years ago, 13,000 years 12, ago.
12,850.
So I apologize to all our readers out there. Wherever it says Hiawatha in our book, you must now insert the Younger Dryas comet instead.
Yeah, you just interpose that.
Both within 500 miles of the Labrador Sea. And
oh, so, see, hang on. the capitalist in me needs to speak up here. What you need to do is make an amended version
and then also
a bonus with some of these stories that you left
that's what we're gonna do.
Solicit, okay.
Yeah, another five or $6,000 down the road. Yeah, we'll do that.
Yeah, we want to look for somebody to do a nice intro, and also we'll make that correction. And also, we have all these new hearings and stuff that the reports and stuff that came out from Congress
like to say, it still was Colonel Mustard with a knife.
Yes.
But he wasn't in the kitchen. It was Colonel Mustard with a knife in the living room.
You know, there were two impact sites within 500.
Same effects happened. They were just in a different location, but they happened at the same time.
Yeah.
And the outcome was the same. So I like to keep things in simplistic terms that people can understand.
But maybe
a little bit of humor too, you know. So,
but the point was, we think that
as the dumbest man here, I appreciate that.
And I've always thought that UFO encounters have been always around nuclear events, even Roswell.
Lots of them.
They were bombers at that Air Force.
The 509th was there that delivered the Hiroshima and the Nagasaki bomb.
And so I have always contemplated that maybe they were interdimensional and we're affecting other dimensions. But a breakaway civilization living underground, we're affecting everything they're doing just the same.
Absolutely.
And our theories, they don't require a wormhole to exist. It doesn't require theoretical physics to exist. It doesn't require faster than light travel. It doesn't require wormholes to exist.
Interdimensionality.
It doesn't require interdimensional travel. And it doesn't require time travel. It's just good old-fashioned rocketry. In the old days, we believe they used rocketry. Remember, when Ezekiel sees the fiery chariot dropping down to the planet,
describing the sound of the boom
and we hear that again and again and again about the Chinese, fiery chariots in the sky.
But we
think since those many years ago that they have now switched to nuclear power in their machines, their UFOs, because when people get too close to them, they actually receive electromagnetic radiation burns. UFOs are almost always silent, too. That's another bizarre phenomenon with the light in the sky. If that light in the sky is not making any noise at all, it could be a UFO as well. Except when they're very close. Then people say they hear a humming sound that is almost felt more than heard. Yeah. And if you are feeling that and hearing that, you are too close and you should try.
What's the feeling? Do they describe the feeling?
Well, with ultra low frequency sound below about 50 hertz, it'll feel more like a vibration.
Like a vibration, yes.
Like a deep humming vibration, but it literally will there's a lot of theories on that too. If you hit the exact right vibration for like a bone, it will actually break a bone. Or, you know, the old thing about if a woman hits the high note, a coratura will shatter the glass. Everything is vibration. Yeah, yeah. Everything is vibration. So everything has got a key to it. Okay. So vibration is really, I think they have us in spades in that, as far as when it comes to DNA. DNAs are like Legos for them.
Right. Okay.
They just play around with that all the time. It's simple. You know, think about how, where we would be if we don't blow ourselves up for the next 100 years, and we don't, you know, go into a nuclear war or some of that. Where are we going to be in 100 years? I mean, we're already, you know, curing certain types of blindness with CRISPR technology. We're already looking at bringing back the mastodon and even the
Dodo bird. I mean, you don't even have to say what we're doing. You just have to look at what was happening 100 years ago.
Yeah.
We didn't even have cars, right? I mean, we had like little shitty cars, like little fucked up
Model
cars.
T. Model T about, right. So, about yeah. it.
Yeah. Now we're flying in the sky and we're going to the fucking moon.
Exactly. Exactly.
So it's exponential. Our advancement is exponential.
13,000 years ago is when most of humanity was thrown back into the Stone Age. Whatever kind of technological advancement we had made prior to that was scraped off the earth by this impact that caused this extinction events of 13,000 years ago. And so,
and that lines up with all these pyramids around the world being built, and you see evidence of machinery being used, but we don't find the machinery.
But the machinery is gone. Yeah,
this lost technology was washed off the earth and lost with water and erosion. And
it was a calamity that few people can visualize. We also think that there was a lithospheric shift at the same time.
Quite possibly, yes.
Hapgood, the guy who proposed the lithospheric shift theory, said that the
can you define that before you speak more on it?
Sure.
What's a lithospheric shift?
Lithospheric shift. Hapgood's theory is like the outside of our planet is the hard crust, but there's the whole mantle in this underneath that crust is liquid, and it's possible under certain stresses that the crust can shift over that liquid mantle.
The crust is very thin.
The pole shift to a different location.
Oh, so it's like a polar shift.
The polar shift.
Yes, yes.
Okay.
We know that one happened between 12,000 and 18,000 years ago. And we surmise that a comet smacking into the earth 13,000 years ago might have been the cause of that lithospheric shift.
According to the Earth sediment, the Ucello event, the Ucello horizon and the Younger Dryas, we were actually coming out of an ice age right at that pivotal point. And then we were basically pushed back into an ice age.
Back in.
We're about 1,000 to 1,100 years.
And the nanodiamonds.
Verifiable.
Yeah. Nanodiamonds had been discovered in the 13,000-year-old soil. And that was the smoking gun for a celestial impact of some kind. We were just looking for the crater. The nanodiamonds form in no other way. They're brought in by celestial objects, meteors, asteroids, comets. And their dust that comes with these objects is superheated in our atmosphere and forms these little tiny microscopic round diamonds called nanodiamonds. And they were found in high concentration around the Labrador Sea. And when Hiawatha was discovered only 500 miles away from there, I thought, this has got to be it. But no, 500 miles on the other side of the Labrador Sea is where it actually did hit. But still, we knew we were looking for the cause of, and we surmised this is the cause of the Great Flood, this worldwide disaster that is in the most ancient lore of about 1,200 separate cultures all around the world, pointing to a worldwide massive flood event of some kind.
Mm-hmm.
And if a lithospheric shift did happen at the same time as this impact, the tsunamis would have been thousands of feet high, 1 or 2,000 foot high.
Yeah,
moving towards the world, the coastlines of the entire world, it would have been scraped off the surface almost, you know.
Does this make you guys religious?
No.
I grew up in a family that had moved from England, and they were Protestants. And I grew up without religion for until I was about 17 years of age.
Me too.
Just because when they came over here, they had some they became Methodists for whatever reason.
We studied Eastern religions for a while. We did some chanting and meditation and Kundalini raising work for a few years in our 30s. But mostly we try and look at this more of a scientific perspective as is more. But there is a spiritual component to this phenomenon with Stephen's family, for sure.
Well, I just mean, so you're treating the flood as more of like a historical event than any
sort
of. Yes,
we are.
Okay.
Yes.
That not just Noah, but there were 1,200 Noahs. 1,200 stories about different guys that somehow
survived. That's how we saved all the animals, you know? Because there was 1,200 Noahs, which means,
well,
I mean, multiply that by all the animals in the world. Like,
right.
Then it's easy. You take care of the grasshoppers. I'll get the elephants.
I know that, Stephen, your experiences are at the beginning of the book to just let people know your perspective maybe on some of these things. But I want to hear some of the experiences that you've had with the abduction stuff. Because it's fascinating. And to acknowledge UAPs and still deny abductions, the conversation needs to be opened up as to what the heck is going on. And right. I like the theories that you guys present.
Thank you.
Yeah, I'll take this.
Okay. Off you go, dear.
All right. So I was raised in a very conservative British family that went through World War II, as I said before. They moved over here in 1956 and then eventually became citizens. So from the age of 3, I was told that we had this family protector. His name was Old Glegley, and that would show himself from time to time to different people in the family. And this had been going on for 3 generations. So I just accepted this.
And they were psychic automatic
guiders. And at the age of 3, I would be visited once in a while in my bed by this being, whatever it was, that would be jumping on my chest and my stomach. It was invisible. I couldn't see it, but it was there. It wasn't a cat, wasn't a dog, but it was playful. Okay, so again, I just accepted it. Fast forwarding to about the age of 10, I was sleeping in the top of a bunk bed in my room, the same room, and my brother was about 3 or 4 years old, because he's 6 years younger than me. I was awakened in the middle of the night by this strange sound that I knew it wasn't the dog. The dog made different sounds. So I got out of the bed and I carefully went down the hallway. I remember my heart pounding and my breath going. I was actually scared. So I was definitely awake. I wasn't sleepwalking or whatever. We'll talk about it, dreaming. I was definitely awake, and I was actually scared about what I was going to see in the living room. And before I get to the end of the hallway, just as I'm about ready to turn to the living room, everything just goes black. Next thing I know, about 3 hours later, guessing on this, I'm back in my top of my bunk bed, all tucked in again, and I don't have any clue about what happened in that time period. Now, my brother, when he turned between ages about like 6 and 8, he would sleep in our closet. And I asked Philip, why are you sleeping in the closet? He said, well, I'm afraid of the little men that come in the night. And because I had kind of seen something kind of weird when I was about his age, I just accepted it and said, okay, a lot of weird things are happening, but this is the Shaw family, so we just accepted it. Again, this is not something you tell your friends at school. They think you're in a haunted house or you're lying or you're just nuts. So we just kept it amongst the family. So fast forwarding again to when I was 18, January of 1979. These are events that happened about a week's period of time that all five members of the family experienced.
Yes, they sometimes come in clusters.
In two different homes. One home 350 miles away that we were building ourselves. The first night, my dad's closet doors opened and closed on him. I found this out because when he came out for breakfast that morning, before we went to work, he said, "Stephen, you know, I got to tell you, my closet doors opened and closed on me last night." And I just looked at him and said, "Yeah, sure, Dad. Okay, it must have been a dream or something like that."
Yeah, have another dad.
Yeah. Have another dad. Right. I'll preface this by I was starting to study Tai Chi at that point in my life. I became a Tai Chi teacher for 23 years and very deeply into the martial arts at that point in my life. So anyway, so I was into also Paramahansa's work. So I was reading this book and I said, you know, my dad might like want to read this. So I gave the book to my dad in the living room. I went back to my room. About half an hour later, about 9:30 at night, he came into my room with this puzzled look on his face. And I said, "Dad, what's up?" He said, "I'm hearing a silver bell." I said, "Really?" He said, "Okay." I've been a musician my whole life, so I know what a silver bell sounds like. I said, "Okay." So I went into the living room, and sure enough, inside the wall, there was a sound of a silver bell. So then we got my sister, and my sister came out. She's 5 years younger than me, and she said, "Yeah, that's a silver bell." And we knocked on the wall, and we looked up the chimney, and there was nothing there. Went on for
was it Christmas
minutes.
Time? Could it have been Santa Claus?
Oh, no. This was January. This is mid-January 1979.
Maybe he was late.
The next morning, which was our habit, we called my mom, who was living in the house we were building, and she had my brother there. And she said, "You know, I answered the phone last night. There was this bell, and I answered the phone, and somebody on the other line said, 'I am the invisible on Beachy. Did you guys call or something like that?'" And my brother said, no, Mom, the phone didn't ring, but you picked up the phone." And this happened the exact same time that we were hearing the silver bell inside the wall at the Fallbrook house, 350 miles away. The next night, I went to bed in my normal room, and I was awakened by a whizzing sound, like, whew, whew, whew. And I thought, well, maybe it's a bug or something like that. And so I decided to go back to sleep, and I rolled to my left side. And then from the base of the bed, my bed was pushed with two distinct, very gentle shoves. I thought, well, maybe it was like a bit of minor earthquake or something like that. We're in Southern California. And then trying to go back to sleep again, and then it shoves again harder. And then about another few seconds later, it shoves again even harder. At this point, I'm getting nervous, okay? A little scared and nervous. And then I get three distinct taps on my right shoulder, just below my shoulder, like in my deltoid, like an index finger. And at this point, I'm really annoyed and scared. So I whisked around onto my right side and I say, "What?" And I feel there's something there, but I can't see it. And then I just go right back to sleep. And I black out.
The family had this frequently where they would see something strange and they'd be frightened, but then they would black out. You know, you don't just fall asleep when you're terrified.
So anyway,
right?
The next night I did not want to sleep in that bedroom. I was getting nervous. I was like, what do I do? Is it going to happen to me again? So I went to sleep in my clothes, my work clothes from the day before, in the living room on the sofa. I woke up about 5:30 in the morning. It was dark because it was January. Looked at my piano, think about what music I was going to play. Heard the fountain in the other room. So I was awake. I was alert. From behind me, from behind my head, from the front door, which is about 25 feet away, this tall blue-white entity, about 6 to 7 feet tall, skinny, came walking, gliding towards me, and in about 1.5 to 2 seconds, and stopped by my right side. It brought the whole house, the whole room was filled with this blue-white light, and once it stopped by my right-hand side, the whole right side of my body just was paralyzed. Not in a scary way, but it was just, I could not move. And I'm thinking, oh, I'm going to see the family spirit guide, old Glegley, that I've heard about since being a kid. But the other part of me, the logical side, saying, dude, you can't move.
So
you're
scared,
paralyzed
and excited at the same time.
So this entity then bent down to my right ear and said, in this kind of a whisper, so I couldn't tell it was male or female. And I was both still scared, but I couldn't look. I couldn't see, but I could kind of tell. I could tell what it looked like. It was tall, skinny, and it was blue-white. And it stayed there for indeterminate amount of time, maybe 10, 15 seconds. And then it left. It went out back out through the front door. And then I black out again. I don't remember to this day whether I actually really told my dad or did I tell him at breakfast. I don't know, but I did not get up. That's what I know. But what I can tell you that's in the book is that 6 hours later, I was getting hungry. It was 11:30 in the morning. So I reached into my right-hand side pocket to pull out the coins and the money I had. And these are the standard U.S. coins from 1979 era. And all the coins were magnetic. Okay. I could pick up the coins with the coins. So could my dad. And we're playing around with this stuff. There wasn't like any jelly on there or any type of glue. I could pick up the coins or the nails with coins. It didn't matter. And so
it's supposed to be impossible. Yeah. American coins are designed specifically so they can't be magnetized.
I've still been trying to find an answer for that.
So they can go in vending machines and things. And then
the last thing that happened the very next night, I decided to go back to sleep in my regular bedroom. And my dad was awakened in the middle of the night by this intense blue white light that was coming out of my room. And he was getting annoyed about this stuff himself, and he wanted to find out what was going on. So he was getting up out of bed, and then a voice in his head said, telepathically, I guess, said, "Go back to sleep, Jeffrey. Everything's okay. Nothing to see here. Everything's fine." And he just went back to sleep.
It's just like the ultimate respite for a dad, right? Like, that's all you want to hear. Just go back to sleep. It'll be fine.
And I have absolutely no memory of that.
Psychologically, as you move forward through life, did you put any emphasis on it? I mean, did you said you're a Tai Chi guy, right? So there's some Eastern things going on with you. Did you ever just kind of break it down psychologically? Did you ever, I don't know, think about like what it means for your life? Like, let's say this is all true, it's true. We'll say it's true.
Right.
There's no reason for me to say it's not true because it has no bearing on my life at all. But if that happened to me, I would be like, what does that mean? And like, life seems meaningless, but this maybe is a clue, right?
Exactly. There's been other things that have happened since then too, which I attribute myself that, number one, I know that that chi energy is real. I've done it myself. I've had it done to me. I know that meditation and being able to I know now why the Buddhists and the lamas and the different holy men will sit for 8 to 10 hours a day in lotus positions. And they're actually channeling the energy that us regular people can't normally channel, because I've had it happen to me actually by accident. I know that there are things out there, and I've had different points in my life where I thought I should maybe just quit my military duty and move to Tibet and become a holy man. I mean, the beautiful thing about this is that some of these ancient teachings are absolutely real. If you are young enough and you're pure enough and you actually do the work, all those factors there, these things are real.
Yeah, like when we were studying with the, doing the chanting and the meditation, to raise teachers. Our Kundalini energy. After about 6 months of doing this work, we started astral projecting regularly. And they promised us, they said, well, you'll start to have these other abilities will start to come. And sure enough, astral projection was one of them.
Who's the most famous naked person that you saw? Because I can only imagine that that's what you would use astral projection for. It's just like seeing naked people famous.
Actually, you know that never crossed my mind.
Me neither.
No, what?
What's the coolest place that you went to travel to?
She went to Egypt.
Yeah, I had a lot of fun with astral projection. I really have always been attracted to the idea of scuba diving, but I've also been a big chicken about it too. I have a bad eardrum on one side.
You don't have to explain how scuba diving is a terrifying thing. Scuba diving is like the most claustrophobic, scary thing.
Drowning, you know, all those things.
Yeah, all that.
But in your astral body, you don't have to worry about none of that. You just go and dive into the ocean. So totally. I used to travel to the ocean and dive in. And one time I said, I want to see the pyramids of Egypt. And when you're traveling astrally, if it's just over the hill, this doesn't happen. But if you're traveling somewhere distance, there's like a little black vortex you go through, like whoosh, 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 you know. And so there was a whoosh, whoosh, whoosh. And then I was in Egypt. There were the pyramids and the sun rising behind them. And they were silhouetted in front of me. I can testify to it really happening. But we started also getting some other abilities I didn't like. You start to hear into the astral realm. It's called clairaudience. And so I would hear voices. I'd be at work, type, you know, and suddenly I'd hear somebody speak right behind me. And after a while, it started to freak me out. So I gave up the practices. But with Stephen, in Stephen's case, whenever he went astral, almost every time,
frequently,
it's like these minds that are persecuting this family are still in touch with him, and they're right on the other side of the veil somehow. It's like they are constantly broadcasting in the spiritual realm some sort of connection to him.
I have a slightly different viewpoint on that. Right now, we're broadcasting right now. Our brainwaves are working about 40 cycles per second because we're in beta. We're in beta wave right now because we're watching a monitor and we're talking. So our brain waves are cycling about that. When you do things like Tai Chi, you're in moving meditation. So you're about 11 to 14 cycles per second when you're doing Tai Chi. When you get into certain types of sleep, either theta or delta, you're down into as low as 2 to 4 cycles. Okay. So we're basically talking about frequency. And for instance, right now we're like, as an example, we're on 97.3. We're basically like listening to 97.3. When you change your brainwave cycles, you can change to 97.5 or 96.9. And some people can go even further depending on what their training is. So literally, like when you start hearing things or hearing people talking, it's like that's being broadcast all the time. Like you hear, yeah. There's a couple of good books out there, for instance, on simultaneous inventions, like, you know, Marconi and Tesla supposedly invented the radio at the same time, but Marconi got the credit. Same thing with Alexander Graham Bell and another guy developed the telephone. It's like this stuff is being broadcast, but all the time, like the Akashic record type stuff.
Yeah, it's almost like a library in the sky that we're able to.
But you know, only certain individuals have the wherewithal and the knowledge to be able to make any use of that information. So you'll see a lot of this stuff were simultaneous inventions all throughout history, and it's very well documented. So like we're being broadcast to all the time, but depending on your training and what state of mind you're in, your brainwave frequencies, either you're going to be able to pick up on it or you're not.
We're actually researching it now for our next book, and we'll be talking more about the Akashic record and simultaneous inventions there.
Right, correct.
You talk about astral projection, though, in the past tense. Does that mean you don't do it anymore?
It still happens. I don't go about trying to do it on a regular basis. It still happens to me. All it requires is getting your body, your physical body, into a relaxed enough state, almost like you feel like you're glued to the bed.
You know, and then your brain waves. You're awake, but you can't move. It's called the hypnagogic state.
Yeah,
the state in between wakefulness and sleep. And some people are afraid of it. They feel paralyzed, like they can't move. But it's really a time of power. It's when you can actually separate from your body and start astral projecting, traveling.
I actually got out of my body about a month and a half ago, which is not really quite the same thing as astral projecting.
When we were doing the work, the meditation and the chanting, I gained the ability to astral project. But as soon as I stopped doing the work, the door kind of closed in my case. But in Stephen's case, it never fully closed, and he still astral projects fairly regular.
I was astral projecting way before we started doing the work with the group that we were with, our teachers, with mentors. That was something that was easy for me, and it was kind of annoying. Sometimes, actually, the nicer times, I would like fly above the house, or I'd fly around LA and that kind of stuff at night. That was kind of fun.
You've had out of body experiences and you believe that there are other entities here in this plane with us. What's your take on, I don't want to say the purpose of being able to travel outside of your body, but what's your take on it being possible and knowing that there are other entities here? Like, do you think, just to add some questions to it, like, do you think that we're supposed to travel the universe non-physical, or do you think that we're supposed to connect with other entities that aren't right here in front of us? It's like you can tune into the radio station of the universe, or what are your ideas on that?
The practices that we were doing, the Kundalini raising energies, those are goals of that work, where you can astral project regularly and explore the universe astrally and also raise your consciousness levels higher. You know what I mean by that? It's where you become more telepathic, more clairvoyant. All these abilities are actually within the human capabilities. It's just that they're sort of atrophied in us. And we don't believe they're atrophied with the Greys and the Nordics, the beings that are launching UFOs and flying UFOs in our airspace. We think that they are not just technologically ahead of us, but also they have not let these abilities atrophy. For instance, we know they speak telepathically to all the abductees.
Well, yeah, mostly.
We believe that this is a further proof that they are close cousins to us and not from distant star systems. We think that they have very similar brains and minds to us, and that's why they are capable of communicating with us telepathically.
To piggyback on what Leslie's saying, I think I'll like answer your question a little further, especially with Chinese medicine, because I was a Chinese medical doctor for 20 years, and I just really took to it like a duck to water, you know, an acupuncturist and Chinese medical formula, and I was learning Mandarin Chinese at the time, and of course studying Tai Chi. So anyway, the thing is, we break it down into, let's say, even in Chinese medicine, there's like even like the seven chakras. In today's world, the majority of us are stuck in the bottom three chakras, which are fear, anxiety, anger, that kind of stuff, right? The heart chakra being the balancer. Then you have your higher vibrational chakras, which are telepathy, which are compassion, which are love, and that kind of stuff. What we have found is that when you vibrate the higher chakras, you're able to do astral projection much more easily, and it changes your viewpoint on life. And also, too, as far as like evolving, I think part of the whole thing about, you know, believing that we have souls and things such as that, if you want to go religious, is that the evolvement of the soul is not to be ending up being stuck in the lower chakras of dying with just having anger and fear and anxiety in your life, to basically to evolve. And that way you can also like garner knowledge of things like the Akashic records. I think that information is there for us to receive at any time we want, but we still have to do the work.
Tie this into aliens, though. I mean, do you think that you got involved in all of the Eastern medicine, Tai Chi type stuff because there was an invisible little man bouncing on your chest when you were a child?
I was searching for, number one, I needed to know what I was going to do with my life. I did not want to be a cabinet maker. I had already done my 6 years, or I was in the middle of doing my 6 years in the military as a
Tai Chi, right?
I started when I was 17. I really enjoyed it because I had a really good ability to remember movements. I needed something to help me to slow down my brain, and Tai Chi is a very, very good way of doing that. And I was a very anxious young man, so that was a really good choice for me, and very, very, very nice people. So I think that part of the whole journey and whatever by my military journey and my traveling that I did when I was young and studying Tai Chi it made me search for something like acupuncture and the Eastern arts. But Eastern medicine definitely was just like, you know, it's like fitting a puzzle piece together.
To kind of put it all together, you guys have had these experiences. You wrote this book.
We talk about our own experiences in like the very beginning of the book. And then
right.
I go into, I call it UFO 101 school.
Crash course
in, it's a single chapter that's like a crash course in 80 years of UFO activity. I focus on mass sightings mostly.
Primarily, yes.
Because, you know, a single person seeing something could be true or not true, yeah, or whatever. Yeah, but when 300 people call the cops and say, there's Phoenix a UFO lights. In my backyard, you know?
Right. Yeah.
Then we focus on those more. And
Do you think that these things, like, what are you applying them to your life? Like, what do you think life is?
Well, that's, I think life is, at least what we were taught by our teachers, is trying to break free from the wheel of samsara, the wheel of karma. Basically, we're being re-exposed to the same things in different lives. Number one, we believe, of course, in karma and past lives.
Yeah,
obviously we do. That's right there. So it's our evolving as far as breaking free of the things that are holding us back, like, you know, things such as like the need for excessive sex or whatever it may be. You
well,
know?
But that's a you good know? Thing. Name some bad things.
Well, of course, greed, gluttony, lust. Vanity, pride,
all these things sound. All these things sound amazing. These are all great. No, but I mean, when it comes to aliens and UFOs,
how does that come into the picture of the karmic experience that you think we're having?
We think that these beings that occupy the planet with us and are living in bases underground, we think that they are close cousins to us that are more spiritually advanced than we are. So they're in communication on a mental level, psychic levels, with the people that they are abducting and the people that are focusing on. Frequently, I think that they stop being taken. Like, we have a friend, and her name is Paula. She was taken as a child. She's 73 years old now. She still is in a very common communication on a psychic level, in the astral plane, with this being named Sumi that she paints constantly pictures of. And it's a gray alien. Sumi is a gray alien. And she's no longer, I don't believe she's still being physically taken for DNA and egg samples, right? Because she's a 73-year-old woman.
Do you think that they're nefarious like that? That they're taking eggs and stuff like that?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's necessity.
Absolutely.
It's necessity. And of course, it's I don't think they're necessarily our friends. I think they find us kind of barbaric.
Right.
Number one, they are more advanced. They are our cousins.
They need our DNA.
Yeah. It's like, you know, we are a necessity. We're kind of like a cow that's being used for, you know.
It's like how we identify that the living systems of a rat are similar to ours and we need to do some tests. Let's do it on a rat.
Right. Similar.
I feel like we just got to the best part, but unfortunately our time is up here. So let me just ask you, you got an Instagram you want to shout out?
Yes, people can read the book if they want to learn more, I guess.
Of course the book is called Who They Are and What They're Up To. It's Leslie and Stephen Shaw.
And we have an Instagram page. Our handle on Instagram and Facebook is leslie.shaw.author. And Leslie is leslie.shaw.author. And we're trying to make the page where we're telling a lot of Stephen's. There's so many stories in his family that we decided to make a series of all of the bizarre things that have happened to the family. And we're posting those. Also, we're posting any, like, our stories of our friends when a woman is having bizarre orb activity at her home and she's being visited by a purple blob that speaks to her. So we made posts about that on the...
She's captured that on her ring cameras.
Ring cameras, so people can go on the Instagram and share their stories with us. We'd love to hear them, and you know, we'll help disseminate them if we can. Also, we have a website. It's whotheyarebook.com. And there are excerpts there, and there's also blogs there.
And reels. Don't forget the reels.
And the reels are on Instagram, dear. And then the and we also of course we have links to our to our various podcasts that we've done. And if you guys send us a link, we'll post it there. I smear it all over our social media.
And then my sister, in England, Karen Sinclair.
Oh, yeah, that was Ghostly Locations.
Ghostly Locations, yes.
Yes.
Well, hey, guys, I mean, if you can stick around, please stick around. Thank you so much for being here.
Sure.
And I'll just sign off to the end. Oh, Willie, do you have any kind of thing, final thing?
What I'd like to talk about in the more is, if these things are here, if they're trying to communicate with us, they're either doing a terrible job or they have had communication and it's not getting out to everybody.
Yeah, we have two theories as to why they're still keeping it secret.
Stop right there.
Yeah,
so we will continue this conversation on a bonus episode. Go to patreon.com/realsci-fi. I definitely want to talk about that. I want to talk about the psychology. I want to talk about all this shit.
All right.
Thank you guys so much for devoting your time to this, and we'll see you on the next episode. And like I said, if you want to get that, go to patreon.com/realsci-fi. Thank you everyone for listening. Just because you're paranoid doesn't mean they're not after you. We'll see you next time.
Bye.